Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in History. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie. Today I'll be speaking with Martin Collins, a curator of space satellites at the Smithsonian, about his really interesting new book called A Telephone for the World, Iridium, Motorola, and the Making of a Global Age. It was published last year by Johns Hopkins University Press. The vast majority of us probably take it for granted that we can pick up our cell phones and call people on the other side of the planet. But not too long ago, this was a distant dream. A Telephone for the World examines how Motorola tried and failed to turn that dream into a reality in the 1990s. The project was called Iridium. The book examines a truly fascinating case study of how American business navigated neoliberalism, the rise of Japan, the end of the Cold War, and even the global as a way of life. The book should interest business historians, historians of technology, communication scholars, and anyone who wants to know more about the mechanics of globalization. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm speaking with Martin Collins, author of A Telephone for the World. Thanks for joining us today, Martin.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the book. It's filled with insights about many topics that I care deeply about. And so I'm excited that you're on the show. So, just to get started, we'd like to ask our guests how they ended up becoming historians.
Well, I think probably easier to answer not how I became a historian, but my trajectory as a historian. I initially was primarily focused on the issue of the U.S. role in the Cold War, primarily seen from a within the U.S. perspective, with a special emphasis on the role of science and technology, and particularly the relationship of scientific and technical knowledge to politics. So my first book was on the U.S. Air Force and the RAND Corporation relationship and the broader set of issues about how one coordinated, relied on, developed science and technical knowledge to apply to the special sort of post-war circumstances, and how the military, particularly the Air Force, sought to kind of incorporate these types of knowledge into its own sort of conceptions of a post-war world in which innovation, science and technical innovation were kind of critical elements, and how that sort of played into the political restructuring of the United States in that time period. So from that sort of kind of basis, I thought about primarily sort of issues of kind of U.S. culture, knowledge in the scientific and technical realm, and how it kind of related particularly into large scale technical systems. And that was kind of the initial sort of framing that I brought to the Telephone for the World book. And as I note in the introduction of that book, I was, kind of initially thinking that I wanted to take that kind of early Cold War template about the role of developing large technical systems and their political meaning and apply that to the end of the Cold War and post-Cold War moment. But I saw that the set of issues as I got into it was much broader than that kind of framing. And I wanted to kind of then explore what it meant for a multinational corporation that was primarily working within the scientific and sort of technological framework, how they were sort of approaching what the 1980s meant, what the 1990s meant. And it was sort of through that that I saw that the category of globalization that we can talk about more was the kind of critical lens through which to kind of look at the story that I wanted to tell.
Great. You tell a really interesting story, a story that you've already kind of alluded to, about the history of Iridium. And at one point, you even call it Hollywood in terms of the narrative. So how does this story begin, and what made the story so dramatic?
Well, there are always sort of multiple beginning points, right? I mean, one of the critical ones, of course, is to think about the timing of this narrative. As I point out in the book, it really begins towards the end of the 1980s as Motorola, which at that time was fundamentally a commercially oriented multinational Fortune 500 company, where its primary products were semiconductors and beginning to get into the cell phone market and other kinds of radio products. But the part of the corporation that is central to my story is the defense unit within Motorola, which was about 10% of its business. And at that moment in the 1980s, after the Reagan buildup in national security funding in the early to mid-1980s, the Cold War budgets were beginning to decline, and that led Motorola to think about how do you reorient, or at least the people in this national security division, how do they begin to kind of reorient themselves to a world in which their funding profile was substantially less? And also, you know, recognizing, as the larger body of Motorola's effort indicated, that, you know, what was emerging was this larger market-oriented neoliberal ideological world, and they began to see their future not in continuing to kind of pursue military projects, but to pursue commercial projects within this new framework that had emerged through the 70s and especially in the 1980s. So the way that the story begins, you know, as a kind of hook to take off from that context, is the apocryphal story that I share in the book of one of the inventors of the Iridium system going on a vacation with his spouse. And the spouse, who is a real estate agent, saying, well, you know, I'd really like to be able to conduct business from a beach in the Caribbean. You know, Motorola is doing all this wonderful stuff with cell phones. Why can't I be able to, you know, pick up a cell phone, and just call any place that I want to do my work? That will sound a little bit peculiar to modern audiences in the sense that, you know, at that time period, in the late 1980s, cell phone coverage was highly limited to major metropolitan areas, right? So we don't have this kind of ability when we're almost off any place in the planet to use our cell phone and call someone, you know, kind of located in a geographic region. So it was sort of very...
It's hard to believe.
Yeah, the transition, of course, in this stuff is tremendous. But that, you know, that's the kind of technological context. So it was presumably from this apocryphal sort of seed that led this inventor and a couple of his colleagues to begin to think about a more global satellite-based system that came to be called Iridium. But as I develop in the book, I mean, the deeper narrative is this one about the beginning diminishment of Cold War military budgets, which would impact this national security unit at Motorola, and this emerging condition of kind of neoliberal market-oriented developments that seem much more promising for the kinds of skills and technical understandings that this group at Motorola had. So it was really kind of a, how do we survive as a unit within this larger corporation? How do we use, as people who worked within this military context, our own skill sets that we might insert into a commercial or market-oriented context and create a very sort of different vision of ourselves and a different place for us in this new market order.
And the book deals with a really recent historical narrative. You know, you go through from the 1980s into the early 2000s. Can you say something about the process of doing such recent history? You know, the obstacles, the challenges.
The main thing, right, is the fundamental sort of hole in the historiography about globalization in the late 20th century, right? And that hole in the historiography is to understand in some deep, detailed sense how multinational corporations responded and were part of this condition that we call late 20th century globalization, right? Under the best of circumstances, it's a challenge to get hold of primary corporate source materials to do this kind of history. So I was aided by sort of, you know, one serendipitous thing and one methodological thing that I'd used previously. And the serendipitous thing was you had this, you know, this dramatic kind of public unveiling of this effort by Motorola and Iridium, that has this wonderful public arc that you sort of highlighted by mentioning the word sort of Hollywood to it, right, in terms of its appeal in a kind of public narrative sense. But after all of that, the corporation, almost immediately after it launched into service in late 1998, began to have its financial fortunes and prospects for success undermined, and they went into bankruptcy in 1999. And it just so happened that in the year 1998, as a curator at a museum, one of the things I wanted to begin to be able to do was to tell the kinds of stories that were coming out of the 80s and 90s with respect to satellite communications. So I had gone to Motorola in 97 or something to ask whether I could get one of these satellites for the museum and add it to our collection. And we eventually came to an agreement on that, and they donated a satellite to the museum in 1998. So I had a set of connections with Motorola and with Iridium at the moment when the corporation Iridium began to founder and eventually collapse and go into bankruptcy. So I went to some of the folks that I knew at Iridium and said, you know, I'd really like to tell the story. I think there's something deeply interesting in this from a, you know, historical sense of understanding the late 20th century. But if I'm going to do that, I need to have access to records. And I went and made this request after they went into bankruptcy. And there was a window of a few months where they weren't sure what was going to happen with the bankruptcy. And they thought maybe just this thing was going to fall apart and, you know, they would just disappear, right? Which is not what happened. And I kind of sketched that out in the book. But arriving at that fortuitous moment, I said, well, you know, can I have records? And they basically said yes, right? So they allowed me to go into a office building that was, you know, fundamentally empty, boxes strewn all over the place. And I just did a ton of photocopying. So I had myself a core archive for doing this. The other part of it was that I had used in prior historical projects was I worked in relatively recent history, was to use oral history interviews. And the book was fundamentally aided by not only having this primary document set of resources, but also to complement that oral history interviews with the actors to kind of fill in the interstices of how one might tell the story.
That in itself is a really interesting story, and it says a lot about the limits of doing recent history. Basically, your opening was a failed company.
Yes.
So, you know, in a certain sense, I guess, doing recent history, the records that are going to be more available are the companies that don't succeed, which is an interesting feature of doing recent history.
Yeah. And I mean, and also, you know, the legal environment has become more restrictive in the sense that, you know, corporations tend to see archives as a liability rather than an asset. Mm. And so, you know, there's all the incentives in terms of having that primary reference material, primary source material from corporations is all on the side of kind of destruction or limiting access. So it's very hard to do this kind of histories, and especially, you know, kind of given the central role of business in American life since its inception, it really kind of creates this space in which we're missing a significant set of issues that attach to American history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for the historian, all of those destroyed records or restricted records just makes me very sad. So another moment that you situate your story in is the rise of Japan, the economic rise of Japan. And you look at how you know, people at Motorola were responding to this economic rise. Can you say something about what that encounter looked like and how American businesses understood Japan and how it just fundamentally changed American business itself?
Well, there's a kind of macro level, right, in the sense that you know, you're still in the, so we're talking specifically about the late 1970s into the early 1980s, when that kind of perception of Japan of as having kind of learned a whole set of approaches to kind of manufacturing for the consumer market in particular. We're beginning to have a major sort of impact on the larger international economic order and Japan's sort of ascension as a kind of critical actor in that order, impinging on U.S. preeminence, you know, that had been assumed from the 50s and 60s and into the early 1970s before events like the oil shocks and all of that began to kind of undermine the U.S. position. So, you know, there is that sort of large scale thing where there was this general perception where Japan was becoming an economic and technological juggernaut, able to outperform the United States, that required, you know, policy and governmental responses to it, roughly equivalent to our sense of challenge affected by the Cold War when we were thinking about the USSR and China, right? That these were of such a scale that these were kind of momentous in terms of the U.S. sense of itself as a world power. And then on the, you know, kind of on a level below that is the question, well, what exactly were these capabilities that Japan was developing, right? You know, at that level, it's primarily we look, you know, within the corporation, i.e. Japanese corporations, and how they produce consumer goods, whether it was automobiles, which was, you know, kind of the signature sort of statement technology that the U.S. paid attention to and that Japan paid attention to as well. But it was also electronics from TVs and you know, the beginnings of VCRs and all of that kind of consumer electronic material, and also semiconductor, sort of the, you know, the core kind of business of the emerging U.S. Personal computing industry. So all of these things at these different levels were kind of affecting, you know, kind of the sense of the U.S.-Japanese relationship. And for an entity like Motorola, they were involved both at these larger national discussions about the import of Japan's rising economic importance, but also paying attention to those sort of within the factory things that revolved around much more efficient, much more the production of much better products that were more appealing to consumers. So, for example, the perception eventually that Japanese cars were more reliable than American automobiles, right? That would drive American consumers to buy Japanese and not buy, or you know, be less disposed to buying U.S. automobiles. So how do you rectify that? And so one of the responses at that corporate kind of working level was, well, we need to borrow from, we need to understand, we need to improve our own internal capacity to do the kinds of things that Japanese corporations are doing. So that was sort of the kind of the dynamic that was toggling back and forth between these sort of different registers of experience in the U.S.-Japanese relationship.
Wonderful. And so globalization and the global are two words that are really important for your analysis. You even write about how global satellite communications helped make the global into a way of life, into something more tangible and concrete rather than just a metaphor. And so I was wondering if you could say something about how the story of Iridium, what it says about the global or globalization, what exactly does global mean?
Well, obviously it is one of those terms, right, that has room for a lot of different ways of characterizing it and different ways of being interpreted depending on different historical actors and their different positions, right? And I think, one of the things that the book emphasizes, which I think is distinctive of the late 80s and into the 90s, is that moment in historical time is one in which the U.S. is the unquestioned so-called lone superpower, right, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So it's, I think, in that very particular historical context that the global comes to mean something specific in the Iridium case that gives the articulation of the global and how it is built up through the 80s and into the 90s a very strong U.S.-centric cast, a kind of positioning that, if somebody kind of framed the present world in that way, you would want to rethink that just given the more multipolar kind of character of international relationships. But there was something sort of fundamental to the U.S. centrism in the political order at that time that gave the globalization, right, the process of being global and the category of the global, a very specific set of meanings. And of course, the emergence of communications technologies through the 80s, whether we're talking about the internet, cell phone developments, or through via communication satellites, the thought of the global was in some sense, very much in the air. But it was this sort of realization towards the end of the 80s and into the 90s that the global could come to mean, at least on one level of register with respect to the United States, creating these infrastructures in space that did fully embrace the planet in its totality, and not in its totality, but also sort of instantaneously, right? It was both a time and a spatial thing. In contrast to kind of prior moments where, yes, there were satellites in space, yes, there were undersea cables, but you only were kind of getting either, partial coverage or coverage that was done at a global coverage that was done at intermittent time intervals, and that there was something to correlate between the, creating a completely planetary instantaneous infrastructure with the development of kind of neoliberal market-oriented capitalism that was kind of the signature move that I highlight in the book and that I think is essential to kind of understanding the 80s and the 90s.
One story that I thought really brought the global into like the level of the everyday was the launch of Iridium. Can you say something about like the press conference that that launched this endeavor?
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's a right. It was a striking thing. I mean, in some ways, it's. And this goes back to the earlier comment about the Hollywood-ishness of it, right? In the sense that, you know, they were very conscious in a way that we would recognize in our contemporary moment of the PR value of what they were doing, right? And to do sort of simultaneous rollouts of the Iridium concept in New York at the Hayden Planetarium, which is a, you know, kind of a world-renowned planetarium, and also in other cities, including Beijing and Melbourne, to kind of have this sort of coverage in these very significant marketplaces, whether in the case of Beijing, you know, kind of representing, you know, the U.S.-Chinese relationship and our hopes in an economic sense for that relationship, or another Far East thing in Melbourne, as a way of both, you know, kind of saturating, if you will, the world media environment with this narrative, and at the same time, using it strategically as a tool to begin to develop potential a list of investors that who would come and kind of join in this enterprise. But yes, it was, you know, from the perspective certainly of that moment and even from the contemporary moment, something that had a kind of a real ring to it. And I think, you know, part of, you know, what one wants to highlight there again is the way in which the complete global was an important sort of category in this effort from the very beginning, right? That one doesn't do this kind of rollout if you're only thinking about a kind of partially global kind of service. It is, you know, kind of in the background, this idea of complete globality that kind of drives this particular kind of PR approach, and the kind of glitz and the spin that went around with it, and the media coverage that resulted from it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's just so striking about your book is that the global is typically it's spoken in these like abstract terms, but for you've come across these historical actors that have like a very clear idea of what the global means. And they, you know, they make sure that their PR is global. They make sure that their, you know, their investors are global. They, you know, they want to make this a company for the world. And I think that's one of the really neat things about your book is just how these historical actors are grappling with and almost like giving meaning to the global.
Yeah, you know, we've emphasized in our talking so far, kind of primarily the perspective of Motorola and its spinoff Iridium. But, you know, they as they went through these processes, of course, they were fundamentally aided, first of all, by the U.S. government, who also was kind of promoting this market-centric view of the world, and particularly the value to the U.S. government and its interests of having these multinational corporations be these fundamentally global or at least transnational actors, right? That this was a way of advancing U.S. interests. I think so that, I mean, on one level, of course, that's not too surprising. There's a long history of that in business government relationships in the U.S., you know, that go back, you know, certainly to the 19th century. But the to me, one of the more interesting things is how entities of the United Nations were fundamentally captured by this perspective as well, right? That they came to see this kind of market-centric way of organizing the economic order of the world via the market as critical to advancing those kinds of values and initiatives that the United Nations has stood for, right? Which was fundamentally, right, to create some kind of conversation and balancing of political power or redress of political power between developed and developing countries, right? So that the UN as an entity would see the market as the means by which to kind of fulfill these goals for developing countries was to me the more kind of striking element to the degree to which this market-centric vision became so fundamental to the time period that the book deals with.
Mm-hmm. So one aspect of that market-centric vision, or the rise of neoliberalism, or whatever you want to call it, was the story of Motorola University. So I had no idea about what you call the corporate university movement, and I was just shocked at how many corporations established these in-house universities with discrete departments and actual curricula and things like that. To address knowledge production and circulation within the firm. And so you have a really just striking statistic. By the year 2000, there were 2,000 corporate universities around the world. And so can you just tell listeners what exactly a corporate university is and does? And what does this say about how knowledge was being reconceptualized in this period?
Well, of course, not all of these corporate universities were the same, right? They, different corporations gave different meaning to that term university and instantiated it within their corporations in different ways. But the part of the reason to focus on Motorola University is just right, kind of that it provides this kind of opening, as you suggested, right, to kind of a reconfiguration of how knowledge is getting refashioned under this more market-centric way of looking at the world. And just fortuitously for the case that I chose, Motorola was probably regarded as the kind of cynosure of this whole movement, right? And the degree to which the corporation was committed to it, the degree to which it implemented it, and the kind of multifaceted sort of conception of what the university could fundamentally do for the corporation in the condition of globalization as a fundamentally market-centric oriented kind of activity. But it is, right? So, there's a kind of longer history, as some of your listeners well know, between academia and the creation of large corporations in the United States from the late 19th century through the 20th century, right? And I kind of share a little bit of that background in the book. But the model that was happening and the kind of relationship and what it meant for both the integrity of the knowledge production exercise and the corporate role in the economic order were certainly kind of different than what was experienced in the 1980s. And that Motorola's motivation for creating this university was fundamentally connected to the problems that they saw in helping the corporation succeed under the condition of globalization as it existed in the 1980s. And going back to our conversation about Japan and its sort of meaning to the U.S. corporate world and to U.S. politics, it was to kind of say that these things that were happening in Japan within the corporation there provided a insight that what corporations do, whether it's in a manufacturing sense or in terms of their organizational processes, were a knowledge problem, right? That one had to make the corporation itself an object of knowledge exploration and knowledge production, right? That it was the subject of what corporations should be looking at, rather than, say, looking out to academia to, you know developments in physics in some fashion or some field of engineering, although, of course, that continued to happen. But it was to put on an equal plane the problem of understanding what goes into manufacturing, what exactly, how do we want to theorize manufacturing to get the most out of what we do when we manufacture in an economic sense. Mm. And that, of course, leads into, manufacturing, of course, is a kind of, kind of a complex system that also includes humans in the picture, right? So part of this theorizing is to theorize what it means to have humans in the system of manufacturing and how we want humans to perform. But, that the framing of that problem, again, was very historically specific, right? It is in the context of markets and the elevation of individuals within the market context as the kind of points of reference around which we saw either, kind of economic value, particular kinds of human rights values, of their insertion into particular cultural contexts and how those cultural contexts potentially affected the corporation. So as much as, how you might, kind of figure out how to kind of systematize machines or processes associated with machines, one also had to kind of theorize the human within that context. And that theorizing was fundamentally related to neoliberal ideology about the individual and their role in a neoliberal market order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to flag for our listeners just the scale of the Motorola University. So at one point it had 500 employees and it had 12 physical campuses, three in the US and the rest elsewhere. And then it also gave Motorola this like really interesting regulatory power in certain countries. So in emerging countries, Motorola University would actually like train suppliers or even like government officials, especially in Russia and China. And so this is just for me a really fascinating part of like the modern corporation.
Yeah, I mean, it's right when you see that, it is kind of mind blowing, right?
Yeah.
I don't know whether initially they chose the word university to kind of establish some kind of distance between the university and kind of give it the aura of what we usually associate with the typical university, right? That there's a kind of independent space in which knowledge and knowledge relationships are being investigated and dealt with, as opposed to a university embedded within a corporation. But it seems that that use of the word university provided some value to Motorola when it was working in these other places, to see it as not through and through dedicated to Motorola's specific corporate interests, but there was some distinction there between the knowledge activities of the university and Motorola corporate interests that would enable people who were associated with Motorola University to do these kinds of things. Training suppliers, not too surprising, right? That's a fairly straight kind of economic transaction. But in terms of schooling, people who worked for other governments in the processes and particular approaches to regulation, that is kind of surprising.
Mm-hmm. And so, in spite of all of the enthusiasm and ambition and globalism, Iridium didn't work. It didn't succeed. It went bankrupt in the late 90s, and that's as you've already mentioned, the reason why you were able to get access to all their records. What happened? Why did it not work?
That's actually a kind of complicated story, right? I think I guess one can highlight sort of two components, right? well, three, I think. Clearly, the technological development of cell phones through the 1990s was, you know, beginning to have an impact on a system like Iridium that was offering global service. Cell phones through the 1990s had moved from that point where I mentioned earlier, where they're, you know, pretty much limited to major metropolitan areas, to having a much broader geographic sweep. And you began by the late, you know, 1990s to be able to make a call from, you know, someplace in Europe to the United States without using something like a satellite phone, right? So that's one element of it. Another element was that, you know, they had this system was technologically complex, and they were you know, rushing to complete it, and there were a lot of loose ends in how the system performed, and so the, you know, the kind of call quality you know, was not as high as they wanted it to be when they rolled the system out. But I think the preeminent reason that this you know, kind of collapsed in an economic sense was just the kind of bank structure that they had sort of surrounding the enterprise, and the requirements for these various loans that they had taken out to complete the system required them to meet certain subscriber targets and certain payments at certain times, which were very sort of aggressive in the months to, you know, first year of the effort once it launched, and they just couldn't meet those very aggressive requirements, and that was what, you know, kind of pushed them over the edge into bankruptcy. But there were kind of a complex of reasons working together, but I see the banking issue as the kind of primary thing that made it difficult for them, and I think in one sense, you know, that is supported in part by the fact that, you know, Iridium did emerge from bankruptcy, was reconstituted as a new company, and that new company is still in business today and recently launched a whole new constellation of satellites, and seems to be doing just fine financially.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk about that, kind of like the afterlife of this network, because near the end of your story, Iridium sort of makes a comeback, or at least its system does, and it's because of the war on terror and the U.S. military and media's reliance on satellite cell phone networks to communicate to and from remote places in the Middle East. And so this is a really interesting twist to the end of your story. Can you say a bit on this?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of, in a sense, a kind of historical accident, in a sense that Iridium survived, at least in my judgment, right? And that historical accident was, you know, 9/11 and the aftermath of 9/11, and the movement of U.S. troops to Iraq and to Afghanistan. And prior to during the time that Iridium was arranging for launch and to begin initiation of the system, they'd already been in conversation with the U.S. military about, you know, having a contract with Iridium, and I think, as I, you know, kind of develop in the book, created a special gateway, which was one of the means of connecting the constellation to Earth-based systems of telecommunication, a separate gateway for the U.S. military. And again, this comes out of, remember, the division of Motorola that creates this whole thing and creates this large commercial enterprise called Iridium was initially, you know, kind of embedded in U.S. Military and national security work. So they were constantly through the 1990s, you know, having conversations with DOD, a Department of Defense, on use of the Iridium system when it went up. So it just so happened that you know, just before as Iridium was going into bankruptcy, that they arranged the contract, they finalized the contract to have military use of the system. And I think it was sort of that contract and then the accident of historical accident of 9/11 and the aftermath and the need for better communications in Afghanistan and Iraq that literally kind of saved the system. Because there was that, you know, basic seed money coming in to sustain the ability of the corporation to get started, reorient itself, and begin to move into other areas beyond U.S. government support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it made me think that the conversations about neoliberalism need to be more connected to conversations about the U.S. military, just in the sense that this, like, market, this corporation that like runs on, you know, like the ideology of like this like global marketplace was in the end rescued by the U.S. military.
Right. That's, you know, sort of this kind of interconnection, you know, emerges more strongly in the 1990s, but it's a hallmark of the post 9/11 world, where there's just, you know, kind of multiple sort of intersections and interpenetrations between the market world and the military, different than existed in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Other marker of this, you know, kind of beyond Iridium that I think people are well familiar with, of course, is the global positioning system, which was created fundamentally as a military tool, but now is so deeply integrated into everyday life, that, you know, that merger between the military framework and our sense of our identities, you know, in the everyday world are practically inseparable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually something that I spoke about with another guest on this show, Bill Rankin, a couple years ago. I think that these connections are really interesting and I think need to be worked out much more in the literature. And so we're getting to the end of our conversation, and your book is definitely not, like a what is to be done manifesto, but you deal with a lot of issues that are really central to life in 2019. And so I was wondering if you could say something about how your book and the story that you tell might inform our present moment, whether it's about things like, globalization, national security, communications and information.
That's always a tough one.
I'll say this.
I mean, one of the things that also is kind of happening that's kind of related to the book is, as a museum curator, I've designed an exhibition that will go up in the next few years on the topic of globalization. Mm. Satellite communications is an important sort of element of that gallery, but in doing an exhibition, you have to think about, you know, how to tell these narratives to an audience, a general audience. And for our museum, typically we're talking about the material is structured in such a way to be easily accessible by students in middle school. And I think, you know, what I've tried to do in that exhibition, of course, is to kind of highlight these broader global infrastructural issues so that these move from, you know, for students who come in and, you know, think about, well, you know, I just, you know, had a video chat with somebody in the Philippines, say, and it was like incredibly easy, and, you know, they don't even think about how it happened. So it's one of the purposes of the exhibition is to kind of make visible many of these things we just are happy to see invisible, right? To let them know that there is actually a structure and a set of politics around the creation of these kinds of infrastructures. The other thing that the exhibit seeks to do, sort of similarly along those lines, especially for our U.S. visitors, is to let them know that these older issues of that come out of colonialism and post-colonialism have not disappeared. There are distinct differences in power between the developed and developing world that are fundamental, these questions about access and availability to the tools, like communication tools, to shape what local communities wish to do according to their own kind of values and perceptions of the future, right? So on that, it's you know, I've kind of turned, I guess you will, the material in the book to kind of creating that kind of message for museum audiences so that they can begin to more effectively sort of engage some of the submerged, not quite visible set of issues that attach to kind of global scale infrastructures and what they mean when they're inserted into this longer history of inequality that's part of our world.
That's really cool. I hope to be able to visit that exhibit. And I mean, it's also, I can't imagine how challenging it would be to represent things like networks, because, you know, like these objects, they only tell us so much. It's in how they're connected to other objects around the world. So I imagine that's a big challenge as a curator on this topic.
Well, you and your listeners will just have to come and see. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're obviously very busy with the Smithsonian and your curating work. Are you working on another book project right now?
I'm starting to. It's again on the topic of globalization, but I want to kind of actually building off what I was just describing to you. Work with colleagues around the mall who work in different kind of disciplines and subject areas that we might collectively talk about globalization through a material lens. So all the different Smithsonian museums, as you can well imagine, kind of approach this sort of question of what the global is in different ways, but we want to kind of use objects as a way to kind of gain insight into how one can think about this from different disciplinary perspectives, as well as tell different stories for our visiting publics at the different museums.
That's also a really cool project. I look forward to it. I want to thank you again for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Dexter. It was fun. Thanks.